Hello and welcome to episode number 23 of the Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. This week we are talking about the cerebellum, roles and responsibilities of the household while living apart, and de novo purine synthesis.
All right, let's talk about the cerebellum. The cerebellum, like when you think of the brain, and I don't know, to me it kind of looks like we have another brain that's down and behind our brain. That little guy hanging out by the brain stem looks like a baby brain to me. That's our cerebellum. So what does it do though? Well, its major jobs are posture and balance and coordination of movement and maintaining tone. So our body is always using its muscles, even if you're not thinking about it, even when you're at rest, you're still exhibiting tone on your muscles. So when someone has some sort of neurological defect, like say your radial nerve goes bad, and so all of a sudden all the extensors of your wrists, all the muscles that make your wrist extend, those go bad, right? Well, it's going to make your wrist drop because there's nothing to oppose the flexors of your wrist. So it's that balance between the flexors and the extensors of a joint to help it stay essentially in control. And the cerebellum is a major part of that. And of course, you know, we're always fighting gravity. We're always, you know, having to maintain balance. The cerebellum's job is to take all this information in, where our body parts are at, what kind of forces are acting on them, what of our muscles, how much force are they exhibiting, and work that all out in order to maintain posture and balance and tone. And then the other big one is coordination of movement. The way I like to think of coordination of movement is our muscles, we have sensory organs in our muscles that send what we call proprioception. Proprioception is basically like body awareness. It's what allows you to give yourself a high five over your head where you can't see. If you don't have proprioception, you won't be able to connect. A common test for this is for a patient to hold, and probably a lot of people have done this one, to take their finger and touch their nose and then do it again with their eyes closed. If they miss, it's probably because, you know, something is messing up their proprioception. So that's like coordination, movement, maintaining tone, posture and balance. These are its jobs. This is what it's taking all this information to be able to do. So to help communicate with the rest of the nervous system, they have three sets of tracts that are called peduncles. To me, they kind of look like arms. I had an instructor who did, I think she described it as like a teddy bear. But we have three sets of these tracts. And they reach out and they hug like the rest of the brainstem. Anyway, they're called peduncles. There's a superior cerebellar peduncle, and it goes from the cerebellum to the cerebral cortex. And it's important to know that it goes contralateral. So it goes from left to right and from right to left. They crisscross going through the peduncles, right? Because it goes to the contralateral side. Contralateral is just fancy talk for the opposite side. But that's how it gets information from the cerebellum. The middle, so this is like the cerebellum sending it information of, hey, I want to do this, right? The middle cerebellar peduncle sends information back for, it goes from the contralateral cerebral cortex to the cerebellum. So same thing as before, it's just going crisscross. Right side of the cerebral cortex goes to the left cerebellum. The left cerebral cortex goes to the right cerebellum. Man, those words get, when you say them quickly together like that, they really sound alike. Last, we have the inferior cerebellar peduncle. This one doesn't cross. It's just ipsilateral proprioceptive info from the spine to the cerebellum or to the cerebral. So basically, that's how it's getting that sensory information, is through the inferior cerebellar peduncles. What else do we need to talk about them? So the roles, so all these things that they do, these roles are why patients with bad cerebellums, whether it's, you know, cancer or hydrocephalus or something, could be a hernia, you know, Arnold Chiari, whatever. This is why they present with things like intention tremor. They don't have a shake until they intentionally reach for something, or they go to point to something and then they start shaking. Pass pointing. They point at an object and try to follow it as it moves, or they try and bring not so much that. It's more they try and reach for something or point at something, and their finger goes past where they want it to go, or their hand goes past where it wants to go. Impaired movements, inability to, you know, stand upright because they don't have that posture and balance control like they're supposed to. Now, all these things that we're talking about with the inability to control their movements and the shakes and all that, what does that remind you of? To me, it really reminds me of alcoholics. Right. But this makes sense because actually chronic consumption of alcohol leads to atrophy of the vermis. The vermis is one of the nodes. It's the anterior portion of the cerebellum. And children, the vermis thing, that's for all my fellow med students out there, that's a really high yield thing to know about alcoholics, is atrophy of the vermis. In children, we also see a lot of damage that can be done. This time, the flocculonodular lobe, which is responsible for posture and balance. Now, this time, it's not because of the alcohol. It's actually because it's most commonly caused, I should say, it's by a medulloblastoma. And this is the most common type of malignant pediatric brain tumor. But very similar effects, it presents with ataxia and the other things that we talked about. So that's a little bit about your cerebellum. Hope that, clears things up a bit as far as its function and what it's there for.
Make sure you check us out on artofmedschool.com. We have a ton of more information, blog posts, any of our past episodes that you might have missed, as well as some really fun underwater photography that Mike has been working on. There's some cute photos of fish. So check us out on artofmedschool.com. All right, so the roles and responsibilities of the household while living apart. What does that even mean? So I like to believe a highly communicative couple. I think we both like using our words a lot. Hence, we like talking to the podcast world. Anyway, So we like to identify the roles and responsibilities so we have realistic expectations of what that looks like, right? And so if I'm not doing what I said I was doing, then I've said it at one point out loud and I should be held responsible for that, right? That sounded kind of abusive, but no, like, yeah, I am going to pay this bill means, yeah, I'm going to pay this bill, and no, I'm not going to be flaky McFlakerson about it, is more of what that is, because we are adults and we have to do adult things. So my belief about this whole situation is he is going through a really tough mental exercise. And so I want to try to make it as easy for him as humanly possible, right? So if we think of our relationship and our marriage as a stock option or a business, I think as a business, where is our level of investment right now, right? I think our ultimate gain is going to be coming from him getting this education and being able to turn that around into a financial gain, right? So it's definitely in my best interest for me and for us as a couple, for me to be able to say, hey, don't worry about all of the boring stuff. I got this. You take care of that. And what's really cool about our relationship is that means I will do those things. I won't be lying about them. They will get done, which then means he won't have to be worrying about that as well as physiology as well. And right now that I'm back in the US, all of this is so much easier for me. It is so much easier. I can make phone calls to people and they will answer them, and they will do the things that I ask them to do, because America's really easy like that because of the infrastructures that we have in place. So, but when I was still in the Caribbean, I did my best to kind of set him up. So the belief was that he was going to be gone, or that I was only going to be gone for about 5.5 months. So I paid 6 months worth of rent in advance, and I waited in line for forever to pay Vinlec, which is the electrical company there. And I prepaid the electric bill for about 5 months, 6 months in advance. It's kind of hard to tell because it's not a flat fee, just like any electrical bill anywhere. It's based on how many kilowatts or whatever, how much it's based on how much you use. And so, so I paid about what I thought 6 months of that would be in advance. And actually I overestimated that. So good on that. And tried to do all of that standard household stuff, trying to make sure that he had cleaning, like laundry detergent and all of that stuff, so he wouldn't have to, you know, hurry up and buy it and figure out where's the best spot and blah, blah, blah. I'm also kind of hyper obsessed about making sure I'm getting the best deals on things, and I will spend probably more time than what it's worth to make sure that I get the best deal. Like, to the extent of, if I was able to work for that extra time, then I would be spending more of my hours hourly. Does that even make any sense? But to make sure that I get a really, really good deal. So I've got, well, no, you definitely want to buy this specific kind of detergent, because then you can use this detergent for other things and blah, 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 blah. So I get a little hyper focused on some things like that. So I try to make sure that he had all of that stuff set up as well. And I also made sure that he had a full freezer full of food, because I'm awesome. And I probably, when I was framing this from the beginning, made it apparent that it is well within the discussions and the agreements within our relationship that this is why and the basis behind it. But I also feel like it is important for me to say out loud that that this is how we are working our relationship together, and I'm not doing these things because of some sort of preset gender feminine role or something. That if the situation was different, then maybe these roles would be different as well. So I just need to say that out there. I am not losing my feminism card by doing any of these things. I do not believe, because I also think that it's important to be aware of those things. So, that being said, anyway, I try to make sure that he was as set up as possible. And now that I'm going to be spending more time, I'm still doing my best to have him be as set up as possible. Because he should be worrying about school instead of everything else. And so, since we still have leftover credit for our electric bill, we haven't had to worry about him having to pay that yet. But sending reminders for paying rent has been important, because we mentioned it in an earlier podcast that it takes 40 business days for a check to clear, which is like 6 weeks or something crazy like that, right? So making sure that we aren't going to be late on our rent. Communicating with the landlord if needed. He probably does some more of the day-to-day stuff, but if there's anything big, I do that communication. Making sure U.S.-based bills are paid, our phone bill, and making, you know, any of that sort of stuff. We are pretty fortunate right now that we don't have a lot of other bills, but those sorts of things. We do have these rental houses in Lincoln, Nebraska. And so we also are making sure that I'm, you know, in charge of contacting that property management company if things are going wrong or if we're hearing reports or anything about those things, making sure that they're being followed up with. And so, okay, so, you know, just kind of managing all of those adulty things. And so the next thing is I am the person that has historically in our relationship always been in charge of budgeting. I do all of the short-term money management, and he kind of has been managing more of the long-term investments and things that we do. So that's kind of how we've just as a couple made that, those sorts of distinctions. And so since I'm the one that's, you know, creating income in this moment, I'm the one that's making sure that, you know, how much we have to go into savings and how much we're able to spend on the daily. And so that gets translated into, he gets an allowance, which sounds very, very adolescent, I guess, but it really works out best for him and the way that he kind of frames his thinking of, all right, I get X amount of dollars and this is what I get, instead of being unsure of what the budget looks like. And so he trusts that I make the budget correctly. And so he gets X amount of dollars every week and spends that on all of his various sundry. So spends it on gas and food and whatever you spend money on all the time. You know, because people have to spend money. And he also does some saving with that money for, you know, larger things that he wants to, you know, spend money on, or any sorts of things that might be breaking or whatnot, because our car tends to break a lot. So, and I, no pun intended, because it breaks too. Anyway, so, but I mean, and so he gets his budget, but things always, we've knowing full well that things will come up from time to time, that a big car repair, or he has an opportunity to go on a trip, or he has, you know, something else breaks, like a tablet breaks and he needs a new one of those sorts of things. He does some saving, but I also can make sure to do the best on my end to make sure that those finances are available for additional things as well. And because I'm working on a very ambitious savings plan on my end, because yeah, we're saving for a child. And so there are also a lot of impending expenses with that as well. And so making sure that we are managing our money correctly is currently falling in my lap, which I personally love, because I think it's a really great puzzle to work with and to figure out how I can trim things down to be able to make the spending make the most amount of sense within our family. So yeah, that's kind of what we do for managing our household while living apart. Maybe I'll do a little bit more detail on how some of that budgeting works. But for now, that's how we do it. Thanks. We launched our Patreon account. Please go check it out. You can find a link on our website or just look up Art of Med School on patreon.com. This is a great way to support us as we work hard to make the most and best content possible. You can find more information on our homepage at artofmedschool.com. And every little bit helps. Thanks.
All right, this one is going to be kind of a two-part series. We've been kind of doing a lot of those, and we're going every other week just to keep it interesting. Now we're going to talk about the novopurine synthesis. What is that? Well, it's synthesis, so it's making something. It's purine, so we're probably making purines. And de novo just means it's new. We're making it from scratch, essentially. I mean, obviously, we're not making it. Like, we're starting with building blocks. But there's a salvage pathway that when we break down amino acids and things like that, we can, or DNA or RNA or whatever, proteins, we can take the purines from that and salvage them. Right now, though, we're talking about de novo, which is actually building them new. So in case you're not sure, a purine is a type of... Well, it's not a type of DNA. I shouldn't say that. It's actually like... It's one of the rungs on the ladder. It's half of the rungs on the ladder. So, you know, you should probably have heard of adenosine and guanine and all these different things. Like, it's the uracil, cytosine, thymidine. It's all those different letters that match up. There's purines and there's pyrimidines. We're talking about purines, which are half of those. There's two major, also, and this was actually the introduction that I wrote down instead of the one I just made up. There's two major sources of energy in the body, and everyone knows one of those is ATP, right? Like, we kind of talk about that being the dreamed of Bitcoin in the body, that it works for any kind of energy source. There's also GTP. So ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. And yeah, it's adenosine like as in DNA. It's two versions of the same thing. So we have ATP, GTP, those are purines. ADP, GDP, they all stand for essentially the same thing, but the same like category of things. They're all types of purines. So adenosine triphosphate is ATP, which is the one everyone knows. Adenosine diphosphate, we're just dropping a phosphate group off there, that's ADP. And then there's AMP, which is adenosine monophosphate. Same thing goes for the genes, just replace it. Purines have two rings, and so that's kind of where we get started making our purines, right? We have to build those, and we build them out of amino acids. We start with something called ribose 5-phosphate, and for the med students out there, that's part of the HMP shunt, and that's a part that you should like know exactly where it came from right away. We should just know HMP shunt, ribose 5-phosphate, kind of like how you already know HMP shunt and ADPH. Just correlate those things, right? So we start with ribose 5-phosphate. And there's this enzyme called PRPP synthetase, and it creates something called, I don't know if I've ever gotten this one right, 5'-phosphoribosyl-1'-pyrophosphate. Yes, I think that's pretty close. PRPP is actually what we call it for short, because that is a lot to say every time. And so what makes PRPP? PRPP synthetase. Super easy. Love the language, right? So we start with the ribose 5-phosphate, use PRPP synthetase to create PRPP. Then, after that, there are 10 more steps. Right. They're not important. I mean, they're important if you're like a biochem major. For all of us who are just doing this for fun or for med school, they're not important. But basically, just know that you have to make this double ring structure of a purine and use different amino acids and substrates for that. And each step is just adding on another part of that. And that's how much it takes to make this double ring structure, right? So when we get done, we've got the double ring. And the thing to know about AMP and GMP, they're basically the same thing, right? With the exception of one functional group. They have the same structure except for one arm of the whole molecule double ring. So that underlying similar structure is IMP. IMP is what we're going to come out with at the end of those 10 steps. So we did our PRPP synthetase, then we did the 10 more steps that we're not going to really talk about because that's way too much. We come out with IMP, and from there, IMP can just throw an aspartate on it. Aspartate is one of the amino acids. Throws on an aspartate, boom, you got AMP. And guess what makes this happen? the presence of GTP. So it's induced by GTP already being in that cell. Or we can take that IMP, we can add a glutamine. Guess what makes that happen? The presence of an ATP. You add that glutamine, boom, GTP. So in this way, it keeps a balanced production of just, you know, what the cell needs, whatever we need. If you have IMP and you got a lot of GTP floating around, let's start making some adenosine monophosphate. If you got a lot of ATP floating around, let's make some GTP. I mean, technically GMP because we haven't made the... We got to add a couple more phosphates on there yet. So depending on what we need, we either make AMP or we make GMP. Then that AMP and GMP, that just gets phosphorylized. We just add a phosphate group on there. We go from adenosine monophosphate to adenosine diphosphate. Do one more time, we got ATP. Same thing goes for GMP to GDP, from GDP to GTP. So we got our ATP, we got our GTP. They can be used for energy. You know what else they can be used for? RNA synthesis. Because those are, that ATP and that GTP, that's the same thing that we use in the essentially, think of it as that the rungs in the ladder. I know we're talking RNA, which is single strand, not double strand, but that's the same, like, half rung that we're talking about in RNA synthesis. Okay, so what if you want to make DNA with them? Instead of RNA, you want to make DNA. Well, again, RNA and DNA are pretty much the same thing, basically. As far as the structure goes, or what they're made out of. The only exception is, of course, uracil and thymine, but we'll talk about that next time. So RNA and DNA, kind of really the same, like, underlying structure, but the D stands for deoxy in DNA. So it's we have to deoxy, we have to take away an oxygen or reduce our ATP and our GTP. We can't actually do that with ATP and GTP. We have to do it with ADP and GDP. So we have to do it with adenosine diphosphate. We have to do it before we phosphorylate to triphosphate. But ADP and GDP can be reduced to DADP and DGDP. And when you see this written out, it's lowercase d. Super easy. The same enzyme does both of those, ribonucleotide reductase. But all we're doing is we're deoxifying it, we're reducing it, we're making it into the structure that DNA can use. We've got DADP, DGDP, we phosphorylate it, we just throw one more phosphate group on there. We've got DATP and DGTP ready for DNA synthesis.
All right, there you have it. That was episode number 23 of The Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. This week, we went over the cerebellum, roles and responsibilities of the household while living apart, and de novo purine synthesis. Our theme music, Urbana Metronica Wuya Mix by Spinning Mercata, is copyright 2011, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This show is not affiliated or endorsed in any way by St. James School of Medicine. Micah just goes there. The Art of Med School podcast is part of the Art of Med School Network. For more information, find us on the web at artofmedschool.com.